Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Shackman. Saturday morning, a story appeared on how Congress needed to get its act together regarding its investigation of the president's Russia connection as it relates to Michael Flynn and counterintelligence issues. The reason is that to many, it's becoming clear that Mueller's investigation is focused entirely on the money, that Mueller and his team are following screenwriter William Goldman's advice to follow the money. Tax crime, money laundering, offshore funds, and illegal real estate transactions seem to be the fuel powering the Mueller investigation. In that story, Felix Sater and Michael Cohen may be the bookends holding up a complete superstructure of financial crimes. Several months ago, Who, What, Why ran what's come to be considered the definitive story on Felix Sater. This week, Michael Cohen, the president's one-time consigliere, is in the spotlight. In an 8,000-word story, Russ Baker makes the case that could almost be a follow-the-dots picture for Mueller and his team. To talk about this, I'm joined by the editor and publisher of Who, What, Why, and the author of this story, Russ Baker. Russ, thanks so much for doing this.
Always my pleasure, Jeff.
Well, it's good to talk about this. It is getting murkier and murkier at the same time it is getting clearer in so many respects. It's pretty remarkable. If I want to talk, first of all, about just the Russian connection in general. When you look at Sater, Michael Cohen that you write about this week, Manafort, Kushner's dealing with Russian banks, Trump Jr. saying that they get a lot of their money from Russia. All of this coming back to these same set of Russia connections. Talk about it first in a general sense.
Yeah, I mean, it is striking. It's interesting how Trump has been able to sort of make the argument, at least to his base, that he has no interest in Russia. And, you know, that sort of famous saying, he says, I've got no investments there, I've got no this, I've got no that. And it's quite interesting when you go from that, which I assume some percentage of Americans accept at face value, to what we find, which is almost kind of all Russia all the time in every respect of this man's life going back many, many years.
Talk about who Michael Cohen is, how he came to be involved with Trump and the Trump Organization.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, we profiled Michael Cohen recently and found him very, very interesting and neglected in the narrative about Trump and these many, many different Russia strands. And let me just pause to say that I understand and commiserate with everybody on how confusing these stories are, because there are so many names and there are so many strands, and the pace has quickened, and so there seem to be stories coming out not just by the day but even almost by the hour on these kinds of things, and so it's very hard to sort of decide where to focus. We did focus very early on Felix Sater because we found him extremely compelling. This was a fellow who had a background in association with some criminal acts and some organized crime figures, who ended up in Trump Tower and ended up being a business associate and essentially kind of partnering with Trump on some very big real estate deals, including the Trump Soho Hotel and Towers, as well as projects all over the world. And so we understood that Felix Sater was very important, and we needed to know a lot more about him and that relationship. But then we gradually also began paying attention to Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen was Trump's in-house counsel. He was a vice president and the top lawyer inside the Trump Organization for quite a number of years, coming in there about a decade ago, and he became sort of famous as Trump's sort of Rottweiler, this fellow who would stand everybody down, from people who were trying to collect payment from Trump to people who were writing things about him that he didn't like. Very interesting and colorful, controversial figure. But he became more interesting to us when we began seeing that Michael Cohen himself had his own connections to Russia, to the former Soviet Union, to Ukraine, predating by quite a number of years when he first came to work for Trump. And so we thought, well, that's interesting. There's all this Russia stuff. There's all this talk about Russia trying to get its claws into Trump, trying to influence him, trying to help him become president. We know that Trump has been sort of strikingly kind to Russia and to Vladimir Putin, taking a very soft line on Russia. And kind of the tables were turned because traditionally the Republicans were always very aggressive toward, first of all, the Soviet Union and later a resurgent Russia. And the Democrats typically were more, let's say, diplomacy-minded. And then, of course, this began to shift with Hillary Clinton taking a hard line on Putin. And then we see Donald Trump downplaying, minimizing, or even denying some of the actions by Russia that are seen as being most aggressive and most problematical. And so when we find out that Trump brings in as his in-house lawyer, a sort of fearsome fellow, someone who himself had these ties to the former Soviet Union predating his coming into Trump, we say, well, what is going on here? You got Felix Sater, comes from Russia, and he enters Trump's orbit circa 2000, 2001. And then we find Michael Cohen, who enters later on in around 2007. You got both Cohen and Sater as basically sort of intimates of Donald Trump. And so we begin looking more closely at Cohen, and we discover all kinds of interesting things. One of the things we discover is that he starts buying all of these units in Trump buildings all over the place. He and his relatives are buying just this extraordinary number of these very expensive units in New York City and Florida and so forth, all Trump, starting around, again, around 2000, the same time frame that we see all this increasing kind of Russia-related activity around Donald Trump. So we find that very interesting. And then we learn that Michael Cohen is married to a Ukrainian-born woman, and that his brother is also married into a Ukrainian family, that the brother's father-in-law is a man who came out of the former Soviet Union, Ukraine, seemingly modest resources, and then somehow gets into this big business with grain from Ukraine, and he becomes very, very wealthy. And then he starts partnering with all these oligarchs, and they seem to have, according to the FBI, organized crime connections back to the former Soviet Union. So as you can imagine, my eyes are widening and widening as I'm looking at this, and we dig. And so we've been looking at all of that for months, and what I've told you is really just the tip of the iceberg.
Right. You know, you mentioned Michael Cohen being married to a Ukrainian woman, and his brother also married to a Ukrainian woman. And in fact, some of Michael Cohen's early investments in New York, before he even got involved in buying all these Trump properties, involved the taxicab business and being involved with Russians and Ukrainians yet again.
That's right. In fact, as we look at Michael Cohen, and I don't want to judge this. I mean, he may, perhaps his family was independently wealthy. I've found no signs of that. He grew up, I believe, middle class on Long Island. But he becomes a lawyer, goes to a frankly very low-ranked law school, little-known law school of no particular distinguishing characteristics. But he then becomes a personal injury lawyer, a particular kind of law. And again, nothing really stands out at all, any particularly notable successes. I don't think he gets anywhere near the higher levels of that field, where I guess you can make quite a lot of money. And then suddenly we see him just, you know, spending money like a drunken sailor on all of these businesses, and they're all, whether it was his family or, as you say, with this taxi business, another with a casino boat, all of these people, all of the money seems to have originated back in the former Soviet Union. And that's so important because it is well known, and I'm not saying there is a connection here because there may be none, but it is well known that the monies in the former Soviet Union massively transferred to a small number of so-called oligarchs, as well as figures involved with organized crime there, and that, of course, it became a priority on everyone's part to get that money out of there, to move it west, and the United States has always been seen as a sort of a safe haven, a great place to put your money. But of course, if that money is ill-gotten, or they just don't want to pay taxes on it, it then gets laundered. And of course, real estate is just about, I guess, number one in terms of the most popular vehicles for laundering money.
You mentioned all these apartments and Trump properties that, Cohn was buying. He was even spending bigger than that in buying whole buildings in New York, $50, $60, $70 million. And it is completely unclear, as you mentioned earlier, where any of this money came from.
Well, that's right. I mean, even if you take the top lawyers, and, you know, top lawyers make quite a bit of money. They can make, you know, $5 million or $10 million a year or something like that. Even those people would not have the resources to make those kinds of purchases. And so it is a legitimate question. Now, I do want to emphasize that we reached out to Michael Cohen and had some communication with him, and we asked him that question, what was the source of the monies for all of these purchases, and he declined to answer.
What is the connection, and when did Felix Sater and Cohn come together?
Well, it turns out that they knew each other growing up on Long Island, and there are different accounts of that, but it has been confirmed that they knew each other, whether they were friends or you want to say acquaintances or quote-unquote ran in the same circle. They definitely knew each other way back when. And we actually see, importantly, the two of them coming together in a particularly striking affair, let's call it, which got a lot of attention very briefly and then sort of vanished from the news. Back in January of this year, there was a meeting at a luxury hotel in New York with a Ukrainian politician and businessman who came supposedly bearing a peace proposal. This was an attempt, we are led to believe, to find a way to settle the dispute between the Ukraine and Russia, with the goal of getting the crippling sanctions imposed upon Russia for its incursions into Ukraine, to getting those lifted. And this politician, who turns out to have his own connections to these people, was at this meeting with Felix Sater and Michael Cohen. And that's very, very interesting because, of course, Felix Sater, and this was intended to pass a message to Donald Trump. It's quite interesting, of course, this sort of highly unconventional and unusual sort of diplomacy, if that's what it was. We're not sure that was the real purpose of the meeting, but that's what we are told was the purpose of the meeting, that this Ukrainian brought this portfolio of papers that was they wanted delivered to the White House. And it's interesting, of course, that Michael Cohen is a lawyer. I don't know how that all works or whether they can claim any kind of confidentiality and privilege by passing something through a lawyer, but it's also striking that Michael Cohen doesn't work for the Trump administration. He was an employee of the Trump Organization. It's unclear to us what his status is at the moment. He had said various things. He had said that he expected to have a job in the Trump administration. They did not give him a job there. He has also said that he is now Trump's personal lawyer. We're not sure exactly what that means because we see other personal lawyers very much in the news as sort of spokespersons for Trump on questions about his refusing to release his income taxes, about conflicts of interest, about other things, and of course about the current investigation by Mueller. So we don't know exactly what Michael Cohen does, but we've been struck by the fact that he seems to have virtually vanished from public view around the time of this meeting with this Ukrainian on the so-called peace deal, and we are certainly wondering whether that turned him into a particular liability for Trump and that he had to distance himself from him, just as he's done with Paul Manafort, just as he has done with, you can name them, the three or four other people who the National Security Advisor Flynn he had to get rid of, and there are others as well that he sort of pushed overboard. That's all very striking because Trump is known for being loyal to those who are loyal to him, and he kept on for a very long time some extremely controversial and I would say fairly unpopular figures around him in the White House. He took a really long time to get rid of those people, but seems to have moved much more quickly with anybody who could tie him to Russia.
And of course, with Felix Sater, he denies even knowing him, denies he could even recognize him in the room.
Well, that was one had a good laugh about that, because if you go to our articles on Who, What, Why, you can see the image of, you know, the business card, Felix Sater, you know, whatever it is, special accounts advisor or something to Donald Trump, had an office close to Trump's, and he was in Trump's office all the time. A letterhead, a special phone number there. So, you know, he obviously knew the fellow extremely well. We've also published a picture of the two of them standing next to each other.
Talk a little bit about how Cohn and Trump actually came together. There's the official story where Cohn talks about he read, you know, Trump's book, Art of the Deal, twice, and he was just blown away by it, and they had to get together. What do we know about how they really came together?
Well, you know, we don't have that whole story yet. Our effort, I think, is a sort of seminal one in moving the ball forward on all of this, but we still have a lot of questions. What we're interested in is this period where he began acquiring so many Trump properties, because we know that Trump, like I think most business people, likes to know his biggest customers. And I can't say for sure, but I've seen no indication that there was anyone who was a bigger customer for Trump than Michael Cohen. I mean, 11, maybe even more properties. That's a lot of properties to buy from one person. And we know, and we describe in our earlier article on Felix Sater, how Trump would sit down personally with some of these people and close the deal himself. And, you know, maybe they'd sit there with a stack of cash for the down payment. But, I mean, he would do this personally. So the likelihood that Cohen did not get on his radar around 2000 when he began buying all these properties seems to me very, very remote. And so what we're wondering is, you know, why was he buying all these properties? Is it true that Trump brand was so much of a better investment than anything else? I mean, I think usually when you buy property, you look at the inherent quality of the property, the location, the value, and he seems to be one of the few people I could see that think that it's a wise and careful investment to put so much of your money into stuff because it's got one person's name on it. It seems to me a very risky strategy. But anyway, at a minimum, Jeff, he got himself, we believe, he got Trump's attention. What happened after that, we don't know, but we do see that this man who was a personal injury attorney who seemed to spend a lot of his time on non-legal matters, including this casino boat and the taxi cab medallions and so forth, he suddenly is in a relatively major New York law firm, Phillips Neiser. He shows up in there in the mid-2000s, and we found out that he and his brother both together joined that firm. The brother described it to us as a merger, although they were this nothing firm, and Phillips Neiser is a major firm with, hundreds of attorneys. There was some reason. Why did Phillips Neiser want these little-known attorneys to come in and so-called merge with them? They wouldn't tell us. But we do know that law firms like to bring people in who are able to secure business, to bring in valuable clients. And it's interesting to note that at that point he was we believe, pretty thick with Trump already. And Trump had a problem getting lawyers because we understand that there were issues about paying the bills with a lot of these firms, just like a lot of banks didn't want to deal with them anymore. And he may not have had that many options, but there comes Michael Cohen, already Trump's perhaps biggest or one of his biggest customers for real estate, and he moves into the Nizer firm. For some reason, they wanted him. We wonder whether that was that he brought Trump in as a client and handled him, and then he does that for a year or two, and then he moves on to work for Trump himself. And the other thing that's very interesting is there's the brother, and the brother also goes into the firm at the same time. And then the brother leaves and goes into, are you ready, the real estate business, where he joins one of the biggest real estate brokers in New York.
It's also worth noting that Michael Cohen shows up in the Christopher Steele dossier.
That's right. Now, that dossier is very controversial. That was the dossier prepared by the former MI6 British intelligence officer Christopher Steele, who was supposedly doing some sort of research or perhaps opposition research and on Trump, and had worked in the former Soviet Union and went there to do this research. And in that dossier, he includes Michael Cohen, and that this allegation that Michael Cohen traveled to the Czech Republic to try to massage some problems that Trump was having vis-a-vis Russia. And want to point out that Cohen denies that he was in the Czech Republic in that period, or that he did that or had that meeting. It's hard to know what to make of that. The whole issue of whether he was in the Czech Republic is complicated because he produced a passport showing that there were no stamps from the Czech Republic, but also you don't have to, you know, thanks to the Schengen community of Europe, you're able to pass across borders without getting your passport stamped. So we don't know what to make of that, but that's certainly something else that I assume would be of interest to investigators.
And not to make this any more complicated, and you've already talked about how complicated this story is, but other characters that populate this story beyond Cohen and Sater, I mean, Manafort comes into the picture, and a whole slew of kind of Russian gangsters, Russian mob guys that are all part of the equation at one point or another.
That's right. A very interesting bunch, and I think those of us who've enjoyed watching the movies or reading the books over the years about the La Cosa Nostra in the United States will find this cast every bit as colorful, if not much more so, particularly Semyon Mogilevich, the so-called boss of bosses, considered by many in law enforcement to be the most powerful gangster in the world, born in the Ukraine, shows up throughout this story, and in our Felix Sater piece, you find quite a bit about him, about Mogilevich. He was a major target of the FBI when he began moving operations into the United States, and his people were believed to be involved with, among other things, Wall Street, and trying to get into many aspects of the financial trade. And we also know that Mogilevich sent his deputy, Ivankov, to the United States, and the FBI was trying to track this man down because they had gotten a tip that he was here, couldn't find him. Suddenly he shows up. Where is he? He's living in a luxury condo in, wait for it, Trump Tower. And then as soon as they identify him there, I don't know if he gets another tip-off or whatever, but he takes off, and they don't hear about him again for a little while until there's another sighting of him, and this time he's in New Jersey at, wait for it, a Trump casino. And so this is all very, very interesting. Sater's own original activity that landed him in with a criminal conviction involved a Wall Street pump and dump scheme targeting the elderly and other people who were taken advantage of, and it was Sater's cutting a deal with the U.S. Attorney's Office that turned him into an FBI informant, and he was essentially an FBI informant for years while in Trump Tower. And of course, we're very, very interested in that. And I would send listeners back to our first piece about Sater and Trump Tower. And the question, which I think is very important here, which is what did the FBI know? Because they were running Felix Sater when he was in there doing all this stuff with Donald Trump, when Michael Cohen was buying all these apartments. What was that all about? Because now you've got former FBI director Bob Mueller running the investigation. I mean, what does he know and what can he tell? And will we ever be able to get to the bottom of all of this?
Talk a little bit personally, as someone that has looked at this story, written about this story, perhaps dug deeper into all aspects of this story as it relates to the Russian money connection, than almost anyone else, the fact that so much of this just can't be coincidence.
Yeah, you know, it seems like it can't be coincidence. In our latest piece, the one about Michael Cohen, we do lay some of this out. I mean, I think it is a fact that the United States is important to other countries. I think it is a fact that the United States is very important to Russia, that the United States is very important to Putin, and is both an entity to cooperate with, but also an adversary and a competitor for all kinds of things, including resources around the world. There's a lot there. All we have to do is look at Rex Tillerson to see when he was running ExxonMobil, all the effort he made to go to Russia and cultivate Putin. So there's all of this very intense sort of bilateral cooperation and competition. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of Ukraine. And Ukraine becomes important as it begins moving more and more into the Western orbit. This is a huge problem for Putin because Ukraine was arguably the most important former Soviet republic. It is considered the breadbasket of Europe. It has its own tremendous natural resources. It is also the place through which Russia runs its pipelines with its natural gas, which is tremendously important to the Russian economy. It runs through the Ukraine to major markets in Western Europe. For many, many different reasons, Ukraine, for its ports, locations that Russia needs for its navy and so forth, there are many, many reasons that the Ukraine is tremendously important to Russia. And Russia knew that when Ukraine went independent, it went independent at a point where Russia could not stop it. But Putin is not about to have what he perceives as an enemy on his doorstep any more than the United States would be okay with Mexico going in an unfavorable direction. These countries are tremendously important to major powers, and so we've got to keep our eye on Ukraine. And so that, I think, is one of the big factors here that Putin was looking at his relationship with the United States. And I think all intelligence services are studying these foreign leaders and figuring out what they're up to. They're trying to infiltrate their circles. They're trying to ensure that they get as many advantages as they can in interacting with them. And we do see what looks like some recognition by the Russians that Donald Trump is a person way before he was elected president who they could do business with. Trump had serious financial problems, and by their own admissions, the Trumps turned increasingly to projects related to the former Soviet Union and people and monies related to the former Soviet Union as major sources of funding during some tough years. And so I think it makes sense that they were aware of Donald Trump at least as a major American figure, a famous person with a lot of influence. And Trump had made it known long before, going all the way back to the 1980s, that he was interested in politics, that he was interested in the presidency. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if the Russians realized that Donald Trump was somebody, a horse to bet on.
It is all so hard to imagine, with all of this money going back and forth, with all of these real estate transactions, with all of the banking transactions, that somehow all of this is perfectly clean, that in the course of this investigation that's going on now, we're not going to find an awful lot of money that was laundered somehow, or taxes that weren't quite right. There's just so much opportunity here for things to go wrong.
Well, that's right. And, of course, these tremendous amounts of money pouring out of the former Soviet Union. You have to keep in mind that the vast majority of the people in those countries are struggling, and many of them are poor. I mean, the former Soviet Union, a communist country where supposedly everybody had shelter and something to eat, and I mean, people were certainly not rich, but they weren't in what you would call poverty. That now 20% of the Russian population is said to live in poverty. Now, that's, I guess, comparable to the United States, but we have a very different system than they had. And so that means that that the monies are not going to them. They're going somewhere else. They're going to the so-called oligarchs and friends of Putin, and that money's coming out of the country. So, yes, I mean, there is at least a, 1% versus 99% factor there. I don't think that you could say that all wealthy people or people who become wealthy in the former Soviet Union are problematical, but by the estimations of law enforcement, a fairly significant share of that money is dirty, absolutely.
And of course, the political overlay to all of this that kind of brings it into a kind of contemporaneous aspect is the degree to which so many people in the Trump orbit have lied about their connections to Russia.
That is staggering, Jeff. It is staggering how many have ties to Russia. It's staggering what they've said about them. I mean, another figure we didn't even mention is this Carter Page, who was over there doing financial work and then became a foreign policy advisor to Trump. We didn't talk about the fact that at the Republican convention they had meetings with Russians and they worked assiduously to soften the Republican platform's criticism of Russia over Ukraine. They have had to reverse themselves individually and collectively again and again and on every front. It really is sort of jaw-dropping. And I have to say, when you consider the scandals that people like, say, Hillary Clinton faced over having her emails on a private server, and the Whitewater, all these kind of scandals over the years, that frankly I'm not sure anybody ever fully understood exactly what was wrong or exactly what the magnitude of the wrongdoing was or the harmful intent behind these things. That Benghazi, my gosh, you look at Fox News, they go on forever, just venting about these things. And yet, if you were to interview the most avid viewers and ask them, well, what is this thing actually about? They kind of get irritated by the question because they don't know. But here we know what's going on. We can see it. It's unprecedented, I think, in history, this notion that one country, a nemesis of another country, has sunk its claws into it to this extent. And I have to say, by the way, I am not somebody who's in favor of beating up on Russia. Our website, Who, What, Why, was very, very careful. We took a long time in looking at this stuff. I mean, I myself get invited on and appear from time to time on RT, the Russian news channel. So we're not advocating the creation of a new Cold War here. Business is business, but I think the American people deserve the truth and deserve to know what is going on and to understand the magnitude and the potential ramifications of what we're seeing.
Russ Baker. His recent spotlight on Michael Cohen can be found at whowhatwhy.org, as can many other stories about this, including the story about Felix Sater. Russ, thanks so much for doing this.
Jeff, thank you very much. Hi, this is Russ Baker. If you like that podcast, please feel free to share it and help others find it by rating it and reviewing it on iTunes. Also, if you'd like to see us continue to do this kind of hard-hitting investigative journalism, we need your help. Please support our work. Go to whowhatwhy.org/donate.